Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 307 for March 13th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
Today, we are delighted to unveil Gordon & MacPhail Generations Glenlivet 70 years old.
That's David Urquhart of Gordon & MacPhail with the week's top story, the release of what is now the world's oldest single-cask bottling of whiskey. I was in Edinburgh earlier this week for the announcement of the Gordon & MacPhail Generations series Glenlivet 70-year-old, and there's much more ahead, along with my tasting notes, the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and since St. Patrick's Day is coming up, we'll also look at using Irish whiskey in cocktails. First, though, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. The Glenlivet 70-year-old isn't the only new release of the week. In fact, it's been joined by five other single-cask Glenlivets from Gordon & MacPhail in the Private Collection series, with casks from 1954, 1963, 1974, 1980, and 1991. More on those later. Glenfiddich, meanwhile, quietly released a new expression into travel retail this week. The Age of Discovery is a 19-year-old Glenfiddich finished in a Madeira wine cask and bottled at 40% ABV. It's being sold exclusively for now at World Duty Free shops in the UK airports and went on sale Wednesday morning in Edinburgh just as I was leaving for home. I was able to talk my way into a small sample. I'll have tasting notes for it on an upcoming episode. Ardmore is expanding its portfolio and will be releasing a 10-year-old cask strength bottling this spring. It joins the traditional cask expression as the two mainstays of the Ardmore line, along with the limited edition 30-year-old and a 25-year-old I saw for the first time on this trip at World of Whiskies in Heathrow Airport. That one was released into duty-free a couple of years ago, but is now available in regular UK retail stores. It's bottled at 51.4% ABV. Look for tasting notes on it soon. Diageo's Singleton series has been available in 12-year-old expressions from Glendullen, Dufton, and Glenord distilleries, depending on which part of the world you live in. There's another variation now available only in Europe, which has a new batch of 15-year-old Singleton of Dufton available in addition to the 12-year-old version. As I've mentioned before, North America gets the Singleton of Glendullen, while Asia gets the Singleton of Glenord. There's a major correction to the report in the last episode on the World Whiskies Awards. Whiskey Magazine's PR agency sent out a news release after the announcement that listed the Hanky Bannister 40-year-old as the winner of the World's Best Blended Whiskey honors. While the Hanky Bannister was chosen the Best Blended Scotch Whiskey, Suntory's Hibiki 21-year-old was the overall winner of the World's Best Blended Whiskey Award. The release with the correction came out after I'd recorded the last episode. I'm told the PR person responsible for the release has received a wedgie. Back in the U.S., Heaven Hill is releasing its White Dog Spirits for the first time. The Tri-Box series is named after the tasting station near Heaven Hill's stills, where spirit is evaluated after it comes off the still. There will be two initial releases. New Make comes from the Heaven Hill Bourbon Mash Bill that's used for Evan Williams Single Barrel and other straight bourbons. And New Make Rye is the spirit that eventually becomes Rittenhouse Rye. They're both being bottled at the usual barrel filling strength of 62.5% ABV and will be available in most U.S. markets. Last year in episode 252, we heard from Chef Albert Schmidt, the author of the Kentucky Bourbon Cookbook. Got word this week that Chef Schmidt won this year's Gourmand World Cookbook Award for the best book on cooking with spirits. Jason Wilson took second place in the best spirits book category for Boozehound. He's the spirits columnist for The Washington Post and also happens to live in the charming yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield. Congratulations to both. Sam Simmons, who does double duty as the Balvenie's global brand ambassador and also blogs as Dr. Whiskey, has put together something pretty interesting. The Balvenie Whiskey Academy is a series of 34 short online videos that cover the history of single malt whiskeys, along with distilling, nosing, and tasting. It's available now in the Warehouse 24 section of the Balvenie website. And finally, it's only been about 36 hours since the earthquake that devastated Japan and has left thousands of people missing. Nika's Miyagikyu Distillery near Sendai appears to have been closest to the epicenter of the earthquake, but it's far too early to focus on the potential of damage there while so many lives have been affected. As I get word over the next few days from the region, I'll post updates on the WhiskeyCast website and Facebook page. And please keep the people of Japan in your thoughts this week, along with our friends in New Zealand as they continue to recover from the Christchurch earthquake last month. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. St. Patrick's Day is coming up this week, and while many people mark the occasion properly with a good Irish whiskey, most rely on a few drops of food coloring and the resulting green beer. I caught up with Todd Richmond the other night at a Michael Collins tasting at the Franklin Mortgage and Investment Company bar in Philadelphia. Todd is the corporate mixologist for Sidney Frank Importing Company, which owns the Michael Collins Irish whiskey brand, and as such, he spends a lot of time coming up with cocktail ideas using Irish whiskey.
Irish whiskey as a category has a lot of promise and potential in cocktails. It's been around for a long time. Some circles of history say that the Irish did discover whiskey. Don't tell the Scots that. But like anything else, with a great Irish whiskey and good ingredients and love and care, you can make beautiful drinks.
We have the traditional Irish cocktails, the Irish coffees, and that nasty Irish car bomb thing. But what can you do uniquely with an Irish whiskey that would be good, say, for St. Patrick's?
Well, historically, one of my favorite Irish whiskey cocktails is the Tipperary, which is 1 3/4 parts of, I use Michael Collins, I use the single malt because it is a stirred cocktail, so it's 1 3/4 parts Michael Collins 10-year-old single malt, 3/4 ounce of sweet vermouth. I like Carpano Antica or Puntames. And then a half part of green chartreuse. And it's just stirred and served straight up. It's a beautiful, beautiful cocktail because there's a lot going on. You'll notice on the palate, you'll have the little bit of the light peat from the Michael Collins. And there's also that citrus, that honeysuckle, that sort of nice caramel and vanilla notes that come from the prolonged aging in bourbon casks. Then you have Carpano Antica, which for my money is one of the best sweet vermouths out there. And green chartreuse, which ties it all together with its high proof, high heat, and herbal complexity. It's a great St. Patrick's cocktail. I also like doing things like punches. If you're going to have a lot of people over for St. Patrick's Day, a nice punch works really well. And the punch I did today at this...
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're sitting at a table with a big punch bowl that you just put together. Tell me what you did here.
Basically what I did, and I will let you be the judge of how it turned out, because I've tasted it a bit, and I did drive down from New York, so I got to be good. One of the things that Irish whiskey is great with is citrus. It just works really well. Because it's got so much citrus notes going on in itself, it's a natural pairing. So this is called the 10 grand punch, because 10 grand was the price on Michael Collins' head when he was leading the Irish Revolution in the 1920s. The 10 grand punch is a cinnamon and clove infused agave nectar with Michael Collins blended Irish whiskey, equal parts fresh orange and fresh lemon juice, some cinnamon sticks, some lemon, some orange and Angostura bitters, and a little bit of soda water to just lighten it up just a touch. And it's flavorful, the alcohol is present, but it's neither bitter nor cloying. So it's a fun thing to do. Punch bowls are great. There's tremendous history on it. And it's a really exciting part of the cocktail movement.
I'm tasting this, and I don't taste any whiskey in here, but it tastes really sweet. As you mentioned, that little bit of cinnamon and clove gives it a little bit of a balance to it. But it's actually this would be great on a hot day, too, I could see.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the nice things about this is, like, there will be sweetness from the sweet vermouth and the agave nectar. And on a hot day, punches are wonderful. I mean, the idea, just have that big block of ice in the middle, and just people can gather around, and it works really well.
Now, give me your recipe for the perfect Irish coffee.
Wow. Say two parts. I mean, if you really want to take it all the way home, I do two parts of Michael Collins blended Irish whiskey, a bar spoon of allspice dram. I will make my own whipped cream and add some bitters to it, and just really good coffee. Just really, really good coffee. There's a lot of great coffee out of Guatemala. I mean, I'm not a coffee expert, but that's pretty much making everything as much as you can from scratch. You've got this beautiful, I'll have this beautiful Irish whiskey, a little bit of allspice dram, especially for cold weather, and just a touch, a little bit goes a really long way. So it's fun. It's fun. Irish coffee is something that, it is a traditional Irish whiskey cocktail, but there's so much more that can be done with Irish whiskey. So it's really exciting time to be in this category right now.
So let's go all the way here. What's the most unusual cocktail you can do with an Irish whiskey that an average person could do without a lot of skills?
I would say just as a nice tip of the cap to Mr. Dale DeGroff, I love doing I call it the Michael Collins Smash. It's basically a whiskey smash, which is half part of simple syrup, three lemon slices, like nice fat lemon wedges, about four or five mint leaves, and you put that in a mixing glass and just gently muddle it to loosen it all up. Add about 2.5 ounces or 2.5 parts of Michael Collins blended Irish whiskey and shake it with some ice and then strain it into a glass with fresh ice, garnish it with a big piece of mint. And it's a really nice play on the whiskey smash, which has its long history that goes back to the julep and so forth. And it all really works well together.
What's the simplest cocktail you can make with an Irish whiskey other than Irish whiskey on the rocks?
Really well-made Old Fashioned or really well-made Manhattan works really well. I do my Old Fashioned with the Michael Collins single malt, and I do the traditional couple dashes of bitters, sugar cube, 2 bar spoons of soda water, smash that up a little bit. Then I add the whiskey and big rock of ice and give it a good stir. And then if people want the fruit, I add the fruit. Otherwise, no fruit. I don't like to mash up too much, but I leave it up to people's palate.
Those are traditionally bourbon cocktails, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are, well, the Manhattan traditionally is rye, and the Old Fashioned is traditionally a bourbon cocktail, but Irish whiskey works really well in that. I mean, is it, purists may say, well, it's not traditionally an Old Fashioned, but it's made in the method of an Old Fashioned, which is fun. I mean, that's sort of the great thing about cocktails. I'm even doing stuff with single malt whiskeys and añejo rum and stirred cocktails together. And that's really interesting to play with, using several different spirits to layer comparing and contrasting flavor profiles.
Talking about whiskey in general, as you just did, what can whiskey add to a cocktail in general besides just a lot of unique flavors, those nice caramel notes we get off of ex-bourbon casks, things like that, the nice dried fruit notes? What can you do with a whiskey in a cocktail that you can't do with other spirits?
Oh, man. Wow. How much time do we have?
As much as you need.
Wow. You can do so much with whiskey. It blends well with other spirits. It's great on its own. Stir it, shake it. One of the beautiful things we have tonight is we have 3 different expressions of Irish whiskey in cocktails tonight. One of the cocktails here is stirred. It's got Michael Collins, yellow chartreuse, sweet vermouth, Campari, and orange bitters. That's one spectrum because there's a lot going on, but it all ties together. Another cocktail has Bonal, Gentian, quinoa, like a Bonal, quinoa. I'm not sure the exact aperitif, actually. So it's Bonal, Gentian, and some fresh lemon and grapefruit and a little ginger and cinnamon syrup. That's plays really nice to sort of the orange peel and the caramel and the vanilla and the spice that can be found in Michael Collins. The Seventh Son to me is really interesting because it's almost like taking a tiki influence and showcasing Irish whiskey, and that's got absinthe, pineapple, lemon, orange juices, Peychaud's bitters served with a dark rum float, crushed mint. I mean, it's really something to know that whiskey in general can go with almost anything. I mean, as long as it's measured and prepared properly. I mean, even a well-made whiskey ginger, whiskey soda is fabulous.
By the way, Call Insurance cocktails that night were excellent, and there's a link for the Franklin in the Whiskey Bars section of the resources page of the Whiskey Cast website. On that note, let's check the emails of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. In the last episode, I read an email from Turner Moore looking for whiskey bars in the Boston area, and Bill Ricker got back to me almost immediately. Bill lives in Boston and points out that the state's liquor distribution rules make it hard for bars to stock much more than the mainstream whiskeys we're all familiar with. However, he reminded me of one that I visited last July when I was in town for Richard Patterson's master class that was organized by our buddy Joe Howell at Federal Wine and Spirits. The Last Hurrah Bar at the Omni Parker House Hotel has a pretty good selection, along with bartenders who know what they're doing. Bill's best suggestion, visit Joe Howell at Federal Wine, taste a few whiskeys with him, and then buy a bottle or two to take back to your hotel room. Also, Turner, if you're going to be in Boston May 18th, the Whiskey Guild will be holding one of its whiskey tasting cruises that night, and that advice goes for anyone who may be in the Boston area. Thank you, Bill. On a similar note, Bruce McLean sent me this email. Mark, my wife is traveling to Hong Kong in 2 weeks, and I am hoping to have her pick up some Nika from the barrel. Any suggestions for whiskey retailers and resources in Hong Kong? Thanks in advance for your help, Bruce. Well, I don't have any good sources for whiskey shops in Hong Kong, but as usual, I'm willing to bet that a Whiskey Cast listener does. If you do, just email me and I'll pass along those suggestions to Bruce. And that goes for almost anywhere. If you know of a really good whiskey store or bar anywhere in the world, let me know about it, especially if they have a website. I'll be glad to add more links to the resources page on the Whiskey Cast website. Also heard from Gordon Homer, who has kept up the Spirit of Isla website for several years. However, Gordon has decided to simplify his life a bit and plans to pull the plug on the Spirit of Isla site as of April 5th. Gordon has excellent tasting notes for many of the Isla whiskeys that he's tried over the years. It's worth taking a look at his site soon before it disappears for good. Finally, I posted the news about the Gordon and McPhail Glenlivet 70 on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page as soon as the announcement was made on Tuesday. Several people had comments. Michael Derizinski wrote this: "Alas, another release that most of us, whether due to cost or quantity, will have to rely on our chosen representatives to taste and report back to us. As we all sit around the fire and listen to the old storytellers, in this case that's you, Mark, spinning tales of distant drams. Tell us another bedtime story. We anticipate the sugar plums." Well, Michael, it's coming up soon, just in a few minutes. Meanwhile, Scott Hartig's comment was to the point. "I want your job." Scott, as they used to say in the recruiting ads for the U.S. Army, it's not a job, it's an adventure. If you have something to say, a question or a suggestion, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. You can also use the Whiskey Cast Facebook page, too. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
We now have the grand prize winners in Isle of Jura's Wish You Were Here Travel Photo Contest. Frederica Catt was the grand prize winner from North America, Malcolm Macbeth, the winner from the UK, and Marika Casolari from the rest of the world. You can see their winning entries at the Isle of Jura website. All three will get to take a guest with them to Jura this August for a stay at the distillery's Jura Lodge and a photography class with National Geographic photographer Jim Richardson. They also will each get a new Olympus Pen digital camera. The Wish You Were Here contest is sponsored by Olympus, Visit Scotland, and Isle of Jura in a world of its own. Now let's look at the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. There are still tickets available for the Universal Whiskey Experience this coming weekend in Las Vegas, along with the Whiskies of the World Expo March 26th in San Francisco. Whiskey Messe is in Vienna, Austria, March 26th and 27th, and Whiskey Messe 2011 is April 2nd in Kolding, Denmark. Woodford Reserve's next Bourbon Academy is also on April 2nd at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. Whiskey Live New York is April 6th. The Inverness Whiskey Fest is April 8th and 9th at Bogbane Farm in Inverness, Scotland. The Whiskey Guild's next tasting cruise is April 14th in Philadelphia. And tickets are now sold out for Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest Chicago on April 15th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
Today, we are delighted to unveil Gordon and MacPhail Generations Glenlivet, 70 years old. With only 100 large decanters, 175 small decanters being launched for sale in Release 1 in 2011, Glenlivet 70 years old is presented in a tear-shaped crystal decanter, each one hand-blown by an expert craftsman to ensure an exquisitely flawless finish. The elegant silver stopper and base are both made from sterling silver, and each is engraved with a British hallmark. Should the owner desire, the silver stopper can be removed and replaced with a crystal version. Nestling in the silver base, the decanter is securely framed in a handmade, crafted in Scotland, using the finest Scottish elm. Completing the presentation is a book outlining the story of Gordon MacPhail and this remarkable whisky, along with a certificate detailing the distillation date, cask number, and bottling date. Each certificate is signed by Michael and myself.
That's David Urquhart, co-managing director of Gordon and MacPhail, this past Tuesday, announcing the arrival of what is now the oldest single malt ever bottled. It beats the Mortlach 70 released last year by Gordon and MacPhail by just a few short months.
On the 3rd of February, 1940, in the instruction of my great-grandfather, 15 first-fill sherry butts were filled at Glenlivet Distillery and then left to mature in warehouse number 6 at the distillery. Over the years, some of the casks were used, and then on the 10th of January, 1980, the remaining 8 casks were transferred to the Gordon MacPhail warehouses in Elgin. On September 2010, the decision was taken to carefully empty cask number 339 and bottle this fine and rare single malt at cask strength, 45.9%.
Stuart Urquhart is referring to his grandfather, George. Veteran whiskey writer Charles McLean wrote the book that will come with each bottle, and George Urquhart plays a critical role.
George joined his great-grandfather, John Urquhart, in the business in 1933. George was 14 years old at that time. And like many in the whiskey trade, he began his apprenticeship nosing, tasting, and selecting teas and coffees that were sold in the shop, as well as learning from his father about choosing whiskies to lay down. They developed close relationships with many Speyside distilleries and a profound knowledge of the spirits made at each, placing orders for new make, selecting and filling their own casks, and maturing the whisky for longer than was usual at the time. As well as offering a range of house blends, they also bottled and sold their malts as singles. This was very unusual. About the time that George joined his father, Inés MacDonald, in Scotch whisky, was bemoaning the passing of, and I quote, an age of gold when the vintages of the North had their students and lovers. It's no exaggeration to say that George Urquhart single-handedly kept the amber light of single malt Scotch burning during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, the decades prior to what has become known as the malt whisky renaissance. I cannot emphasize this strongly enough. In 1969, Professor David Dykus was able to list only 27 single malts. Even some of these were described as rare, and others were available only in G&M bottlings. When Wallace Milroy joined his brother Jack in the Soho wine market in 1970, they stocked only four proprietary bottled malts: Glenfiddich, Glengrant, the Glenlivet, and Tomartin. That was the norm then, Jack told me. There was some Lafroig around, but they didn't want to sell it. Blends were the thing.
During his comments, Charles described this as a miracle cask. I asked him to explain when we talked later.
It is very surprising but this is Gordon and MacPhail, you see, because had the cask belonged to the distillery or the overall owners of Glenlivet, the chances are it would have gone into a deluxe blend a long, long time ago. Gordon and MacPhail have long had this policy of laying down casks and keeping them for a longer period, well, as I was saying, longer than usual. And indeed, nowadays, I was talking to Ewan McIntosh just earlier, and they've now done they've looked at all their casks and the new filled casks, and they've marked them, 25 years, depending on, of course, how the maturation proceeds. But their stock is already allocated 40, 50 years maturation. Now, at the time that this one was laid down, it's unlikely that they would have realized the interest and indeed the price that this whiskey would achieve. But I was working out just a moment ago. It works out at £13,000, the 70cl bottle, it works out at £460 a nip. £460 a measure. According to my calculator, anyway.
And your tasting notes on this, what did you get when you tasted it, since you did the official tasting notes?
I was able to look at it. They gave me a sample big enough to visit several times. And what impressed me most of all was the freshness of it. It was a wonderful combination of vitality and long, long, long aging. Now, the vitality was surprising because, as I'm sure you're aware, Mark, the old whiskies are not necessarily better. If they're good, they're great. But the you can get this flattening out, and you can get the taste can be the overall flavor can be completely dominated by wood. The wood is scarcely apparent on the nose. The nose is really it's fresh and vibrant. It's fruit salad. It's pine. You're getting maybe some light scented wood, sandalwood, coming in on the nose and so on. But it's in the mouth, really, that it becomes really exciting, because it has this light sweetness to start with, and then this lovely acidity, this fresh acidity, very, very long finish, and then for the first time, a little bit of smoke in the back of the taste, and this long, long aftertaste of bung cloth. Hessian, burlap, as you Americans say, this lovely, it's maturation warehouse, which again you'd only get with a long matured whiskey. So, why it's so interesting to me is that it's a combination of fresh characteristics and aged characteristics.
It seems that the really good old whiskies have these very fruity notes to them for some reason. If they're really good, we don't get the oak in there, but we get a lot of these tropical fruit notes. I remember the Mortlach 70 from last year had a lot of mango to it, some pineapple, some coconut notes that were very vibrant to it. Perhaps it was a little more nectar-like in the thickness than this is, but they're both, I mean, when you get to that point, they're outstanding that they get to this point without tasting like a barrel stave.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's peril, because it can, at this sort of age, it can taste so woody. But it's surprising that these, and it's a good sign that these wonderful, distillery characteristics, original inherent characteristics, these fruity characteristics have been softened and developed by the wood, but not overcome by it. So you're getting this lovely combination of flavors.
What do you think is next? What do you think they've got in the warehouse that is coming next year?
I don't know. I've heard that there may be some very interesting Kleinlich there, and I was introducing them to Serge Valentin, who has written a definitive account. He is the world's expert on Brora and Kleinlich. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm hoping that there might be some Kleinlich and that we might get an interesting little book by Serge about Brora and Kleinlich. But that's entire speculation.
Last April, Michael Urquhart gave me the chance to taste the Mortlach 70 at his family's warehouse in Elgin. We sat down for a few minutes after the announcement.
Okay, this was the cask that you showed me in the warehouse last April in Elgin, and we were talking about it then, and you pointed out this little Glenlivet sign on it with a 1940, and I was wondering then if this was going to be the next one you bottled, and it was a watch this space thing. At that point, did you know you were going to bottle it for this year?
We've always got plans. We launched a 70-year-old from Mortlach last year, and we thought, well, how long is this going to take to go and sell through? We were astonished that it sold out so quickly. The 70cl, the large-sized decanter bottles, were all sold or spoken for within 2 weeks. And the remainder of the 20cls were sold out pretty quickly by the end of last calendar year. So really, with that kind of uptake, we thought, well, I think it's important to go and come out with another one. And we had the cask there, and we've got lots of casks of greatly aged single malts, so it's important to kind of check their quality, make sure their strength is still keeping up, and then make them available in bottle when we think the time is right.
Now, this one was bottled at 45.4 ABV. You could have let this sit for another year or two if you'd wanted to, right?
Yeah, but you know, we've been laying down whiskies from over the 115 years that Gord MacPhail's been in existence. So we do have an unrivaled range of single cask of single malt whiskey. So watch the space.
What made this one unique in terms of not only the taste profile but the history behind it? Because your family had this cask filled back in 1940, right as Great Britain was entering World War II. And to have it survive for 70 years, as we've heard during the presentation today, was nothing short of a miracle that it, first of all, made it through World War II to begin with, but that it didn't get used until 2010.
Yeah, it's when you look through the history, it's remarkable it's stayed there, and that the liquid has stayed there, and also the strength has stayed up. It would have been filled at overproof. It would have been about in the kind of 70%, low to mid 70%. So it held the strength up really nicely. But generations epitomizes what we do at Gord MacPhail. We're laying down whiskey in one generation, and maybe not bottling it for another two generations thereafter. And it is this kind of long-term vision that we take. And you know, my grandfather and father were deemed to be eccentric because of taking this view way back in the kind of early 40s and 50s. But we still carry on doing that today. It's just our way of life. And so there's whiskies that we're laying down today that might not be bottled until I'm dead and buried. So you know, but that's our philosophy.
Tell me about the taste of this one, because I'm assuming that you tasted this over a number of years as it was approaching 70 years old. How did it change in taste as you started getting a chance to become familiar with this cask?
Glenlivet's a fantastic whiskey. The lovely, light, elegant, fruity notes coming through. And certainly when you taste the whiskey, you just get that kind of youthful vibrancy. We saw it with the Mortlach as well. Although the Mortlach is a fuller-bodied spirit, Glenlivet is a lot lighter. But it still has not lost that kind of fruitiness and vibrancy, and as Charlie called it, a voluptuous whiskey. Lots of taste profile there. And what's interesting is that when you look at whiskies that have been filled over the years, because at Gord MacPhail we're basically like a library. We can look at whiskies throughout the whole kind of years of that they've been laid down. You do start to see some kind of characteristics coming through. In this case, you get some smoke. I remember the malting would have been done at the distillery in those days, and so it wasn't so exact as, say, commercial maltsters are doing it today, because you know, how cold was it in the day? How much heat had to be introduced to go in drying the malt in the malting process? All these things would have had an impact on it. And they kind of stay there all the way through. So it really is amazing and astonishing how well that a lot of these kind of characteristics have stayed there all the way through its 70 years of existence.
You talk about the whiskey over the ages, and one thing that was not mentioned today, but that is coming out in addition to the Glenlivet 70, was this decades range of Glenlivets from the 50s on up. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, we decided to celebrate the launch of the second edition of Generations to come out with a complimentary range under our private collection label. of whiskies from, again, Glenlivet Distillery from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, so that people can go and experience that journey through the decades a lot quicker than the 40 years in between. But it's how, so people can go and try them and just see how the subtleness kind of changes. And there's different casts, from first of all sherry hogsheads through to some bourbon casts, so you get the kind of variation coming through in the cask as well. They're really great, and we're delighted to go and release that at the same time. So really we do have the Glenlivet decades from the 1940s through to the 1990s.
And your family has a close relationship with Chivas Brothers, and the current owners of the Glenlivet, and with the families that owned it before that, with the Grant family. Tell me about that heritage, because a lot, for instance, Alan Winchester, the master distiller from the Glenlivet, was here today. There are a number of distilleries that are not fond of cooperating with or even acknowledging bottlings from independent bottlers. But in this case, there's a very close relationship, right?
Yeah, we've been filling whiskies from the majority of distilleries in Scotland throughout our 115 years existence. And if you think back historically to the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of whiskey would have been made by distillers and sold to a blender who were a separate business. And they were selling to Gordon MacPhail just as they sold to the blenders. And we did do some blend, but again, we were laying down whiskey for that longer-term maturation. And, you know, I remember a story my father told of, you know, my grandfather going to bottle some casks, and he'd speak to the distillery and saying, we're going to go and bottle these casks. I hope you don't mind. And they said, no, that's great. But do you mind using the distillery label? Because that way you'll just advertise the distillery name, because all their whiskey was going into blend and it was lost. And we did this, and we still use the original distillery label to this day. So, for example, the Smith's Glenlivet label, Strathyla, and the Glen Grant labels, they're the original distillery label. So this, it really emphasizes how our relationship with these distillers and others have lasted all the way through, because at the end of the day, quality is just so close to our hearts. We are not going to go and put our bottling of a single malt that we are not happy with. So quality is utmost, and we've built our reputation up over 115 years. And what we're looking to do is complement what the distillers are doing. We're not looking to go and fight them head on. And really what we're looking to do is give a wide range of choice to the consumer. So it really opens up and the breadth of experience quite dramatically, so that they have a great experience, because the more people that enjoy single malt Scotch whisky, is great for the whole industry, because it just kind of widens the appeal to younger people, to females, to older people. So it just makes it really, really exciting.
Do you ever have these distilleries come back to you and try to buy back casks? Because when I asked Alan what the oldest cask of Glenlivet they have under their control is, he wasn't quite sure, but he knows it's nowhere near 70 years old.
I think that it comes back to the kind of philosophy. We were maybe deemed to be eccentric as well. But all along, we're looking for this kind of long-term maturation, as well as we do younger whiskies as well. And really what we're looking to do is give the consumer a wide range of choice. And we've got whiskies there that will kind of satisfy every budget, from young 8-year-old whiskies, indeed, up to the 70-year-old, which has got a UK retail price of £13,000. Except that's a lot of money, but we do a smaller 20cl decanter, which is a UK retail price of about £3,200, so that, you know, we fully expect there to be groups of maybe four or five people who say, well, let's go together and go and open one, to go and experience this unique whisky, because life is all about variety. You know, variety is the spice of life. So, hey, here's some variety.
The one question I have, when you're looking at these casks in your warehouse, and you're looking at casks that are maybe 20, 30 years old, at what point do you guys decide this cask could be a 60 or a 70-year-old cask? At what point do you start earmarking these casks and saying, this is something we're not going to touch for 20, 30, maybe 40 years? Do you know that soon in the cask development that this is going to really age well?
We've got, as I was saying, 115 years experience of how different single malts mature and different types of casks. So we're actually taking the decision of whether we're going to go for a long-term maturation or a short-term maturation when we fill the whiskey. And so therefore what we're going to look at is the style of the cask, first fill, refill, bourbon, sherry, and the style with in comparison to the style of the whiskey, so that then looking if it's a light, medium or heavy bodied style, and looking to get that combination right, so when we go and bottle it, the cask character goes and complements the distillery character so that one isn't overtaking the other. So when we fill the cask, we're looking at that at the outset, and then we'll monitor it to make sure that it's going according to plan, and we'll just kind of keep an eye on it, and then if it starts maturing too quickly, then we'll maybe change course, or if we can see that it's kind of holding its strength up and the characteristics are not getting out of balance, then we'll keep on going for maturing whiskies for that longer period of time. So really, it's our experience over 115 years is really looking to go and see how when we go and bottle them, but we're making that decision when we fill the casks.
So your grandfather, when this cask was filled in 1940, was saying, we're going to let this sit for 50, 60, 70 years.
Yeah, who knows what was going through his mind, but we've always had this philosophy about bottling whiskies as single malts and looking at that longer-term maturation. Remember, back until the mid-1800s, whiskey was sold just as a single malt whiskey. It was the advent of blend coming through and the change to the Whiskey Act, and then the phylloxera beetle devastating the vineyards of France in the late 1800s, which gave the opportunity to blended Scotch whiskey. People jumped in and grabbed that opportunity. But we still went back to the way that we used to go and that single malts were sold, and going back to a single malt. And I'm sure in the next 100 years, fashions will change again, but we'll still keep on doing what we're doing.
Of course, the Glenlivet is one of the world's best-selling single malts, but this whiskey is far rarer than any official bottling from the Glenlivet. Current master distiller Alan Winchester was on hand for the occasion.
Okay, Alan, you've had your first taste of this. What do you think?
Well, totally honored to be tasting this 70-year-old the Glenlivet whiskey today. Actually quite surprised by it. As Charlie has said, the first thing it says to us is the nose has so much of the characters that we would recognise in the Glenlivet of today, particularly the 18 and that. But for something that's 70-year-old to be so fresh, first thing I was looking for in a whisky of this age was a bit of peat in the nose for a Speyside. There's an absence of peat in the nose, but maybe maturation's matured that out. But there is a smokiness in the palate. Very nice, very interesting, and a lovely spirit, beautiful spirit. To see something as old as that is fascinating for me as the master distiller, the current guardian of this sort of spirit. So it's interesting to see that we're not a million miles away from the spirit. The bottlings, Gordon MacPhail have always bottled Smith's Glenlivet, I think's the brand name they bottled it under. And that's been part of a history of making malt whiskey in Scotland.
What's the oldest cask you have at the distillery that Chivas Brothers owns?
I was racking my brain when this was unveiled as the 1940. I'm not sure if we have any 1950s Glenlivets at the distillery. We would definitely have spirits that date back to this. The 1950s, but today I must find that question out. That's a good question, Mark. I'm unprepared.
The other thing they're releasing today is this series of Glenlivet through the decades with 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Give me your take on that. Have you had a chance to taste any of these yet?
Obviously not the ones that Gordon MacPhail have got for us today. Obviously, I've tasted cellar collections and whiskies from the 60s through to the present day. Again, it's fascinating. I'm a distiller, so I often think, who was a distiller? How did they do it? What were they doing different? What was the things they were thinking about then? Obviously, Gordon MacPhail in 1940 laid that probably down as a single malt. So that was very foresighted. Could you imagine doing it? I can't imagine doing something today for 70 years' time. But that's amazing. That is amazing. Liquid history.
The Glenlivet 70 will sell for £13,000 a bottle, or $21,000 at today's exchange rates. By way of comparison, last year's Mortlach 70 went for £10,000. Keir Sword of Royal Mile Whiskies will be stocking the Glenlivet 70.
I thought for a whiskey that had been in cask for so long, it was remarkably balanced. It was on the nose, it was woody, obviously, but not as woody as you'd expect. And, you know, there were other flavours in there that balanced it well.
Do you think you can sell it at £13,000?
I think we have maybe sold a bottle this afternoon, in fact. So yeah, looks like it.
Is there a market for whiskies at £13,000 that other than just the 100 bottles that might be available?
I think there is a market, but it's a small market. You know, there are clearly these financial times, there are not a lot of people with that sort of money to spend on whiskey. But there are a few people, and you know, they love their whiskies as much as the rest of us and are willing to pay. So,
I can't let you go without asking you to comment on your award over the weekend from the Icons of Whiskies Awards for Royal Mile, winning the Multiple Outlet Retailer of the Year from Whiskey Magazine.
All of us at Royal Mile Whiskies are delighted. It's you know, it's the staff that win that award. We've got a great bunch of guys working for us, and they, you know, they've won the award on a number of years, and we're all delighted by it.
You may recall my tasting notes last April for the Mortlach 70. It's one of only three whiskies I've scored a 98. Will the Glenlivet 70 be the fourth? The whiskey of the week is the only entry in the What I'm Tasting This Week department. The nose is fresh and vibrant with notes of pineapple, furniture polish, beeswax, and a touch of vanilla. The taste is that of a whiskey half its age or younger. Again, fresh and vibrant with vanilla, pineapple, a hint of mango, a touch of peat smoke, and a waxy mouthfeel. Overall, very smooth and well-balanced. The finish is amazingly long and slightly smoky with notes of dried fruits, banana, and pineapple. The only thing is that it's not quite as thick as the Mortlach 70 was. Just a little thinner, but still very excellent. I'm giving the Gordon & McPhail Generations Glenlivet 70 a score of 96. Now, we heard about the five decades of Glenlivet single casks that are being released along with the Glenlivet 70. I'm still working on the tasting notes for them. They'll first appear in this month's edition of the WhiskeyCast email newsletter. If you're not already receiving it, you can still sign up at the WhiskeyCast website. Finally, I'd like to thank Michael and David Urquhart and everyone at Gordon & McPhail for their hospitality this week. In the interests of transparency, Gordon & McPhail did cover my travel expenses for the visit. At this point, it's also appropriate to mention my policy on embargoes. If you're not familiar with that term, it's used when a news source wants to release information to the media in advance, under the agreement that a media outlet will hold that story until a specific time. It's a fairly common practice, and my policy is to honor embargoes, as was the case with this story. I've known this was coming for about 3 weeks or so, but my rule is to honor an embargo unless another media outlet breaks it. And if that happens, well, then all bets are off. It's the same rule that most mainstream news organizations do use, but I've not explained it here before. And since I was mentioning before I left on Facebook that I was heading to Edinburgh, but couldn't say why, I think you deserve an explanation just why I didn't say anything specific. If you have questions or want to take issue with me on this, I would love to hear from you. You can email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, or you can post a comment on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. You'll find a link to the Facebook page at the WhiskeyCast website, along with the calendar of events, my tasting notes for more than 500 different whiskeys, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cast Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.